cigarettes and the ghettos play. Long nights on a hot summer's block where you sip your brew and never touch your glass. This is for eyes that cry like yours and learn to smile again. Rise above the pain. This is for you and your crew, the ones that's true.
Spitfire breathes the lives of women of color in Montreal. We come together to say no to the silencing of our voices.
Don't let a misguide you. They'll have you acting like the sun don't shine and the sky ain't ever blue. But you know and I know it's all about survival. The struggle of our people is like that unrivaled. For politicians, they was never in control. It's deeper.
Welcome to Spitfire. Today, we have a jam-packed show for you. It's 6.02 p.m. at CKUT 90.3 FM. We are live in studio with Spitfire hosts Mercedes, Victoria, me, Gao, Alyssa, and Simi.
Today, Mercedes pays homage to the phenomenal woman Maya Angelou, who passed away earlier this month.
Attention, unmarried straight ladies. If you made your man 300 sandwiches, should he put a ring on it? Sinmi breaks it down for us.
And Navajo activist Amanda Blackhorse gets an NFL trademark revoked. We play an excerpt of her speaking last week after explaining why the suit was made, why the word is a slur, and the historical origin of the word.
We will also honor the life of Yuri Kachiyama, as well as salute Laverne Cox in her appearance earlier this month on Time Magazine. All that and more coming right now on Spitfire Radio on CKUT 90.3 FM.
Roll it down. control. Roll it, gal. Roll it, gal. Slow roll. Slow roll.
That's right.
Fast roll. Fast roll. Out of control. Out of control. Roll it, gal.
Welcome back to Spitfire. The time is 6:07 p.m.
We wanted to take a moment today to congratulate trans woman of color Laverne Cox, who was featured on the cover of Time magazine earlier this month. Currently a star on the Netflix drama Orange is the New Black, Laverne Cox has become an icon and leading advocate of the trans movement, using her public platform to fight for equal rights across the U.S. We'll go to a clip now of her speaking on issues of race and class in the movement for social justice for transgendered peoples.
A lot of it is just about listening to transgender people and taking the lead from trans folks. The reality is that I don't represent the entirety of the trans community. There are multiple experiences and multiple relationships to one's identity. And so it's really about listening to individuals in terms of how they define themselves and describe themselves and taking people at their word. Being willing to let go of what preconceptions we might have about people who are different from us and taking people on their own terms. When we look at the discrimination that transgender people face, there tends to be intersections of race and class. The homicide rate, for example, right, in the LGBTQ community is highest amongst trans women. And then when we look at the trans women who are being victims of violence most, it's usually trans women of color. So there's something about race intersecting with the gender issues that we have to look at if we're really interested in ending violence against trans women, for example, and trans people in general. If you want to improve the unemployment rate in the trans community, if you want to stop the bullying of LGBTQ youth, we also have to look at race. And I think the trans movement and the LGBT movement in general really has to be a social justice movement where we look at issues of race and class and just xenophobia in general.
So I'm now going to take a moment to pay tribute to the late Dr. Maya Angelou.
Yo, yo, yo.
Yay! So when we look up the definition of phenomenal in any dictionary, some of the definitions that we are presented with are very good or great, unusual in a way that is very impressive, very remarkable, extraordinary. Synonyms include amazing, sensational, stunning, incredible, or even unbelievable. However, phenomenal is just one word to be able to describe the person who is Maya Angelou. I will not attempt to list the words that could describe Maya Angelou, for it is a task I will surely fail, because no one word can truly embody her essence. That unadulterated kindness, love, and openness she not only had for humanity, but for everyone who had the opportunity to come face to face with her resounding presence. I may be overselling her personhood, but do you blame me? The wonder and awe that one feels when thinking about what Maya Angelou has accomplished with her time on this earth can leave one speechless. Not because of the magnitude of her tasks, or how impressive they may be, but out of respect for who she is, what she has done, and the legacy she has left behind that has impacted people of all different races, creeds, and gender. All I can do is try to convey my appreciation in a way that will do justice to the memory of Dr. Maya Angelou. Born on April 4th, 1928 in St. Louis, Missouri, as Margaret Annie Johnson, life for Dr. Angelou was not an easy one growing up. Do not forget, this was a time where the United States was wrought with racial discrimination against blacks, and this was one of the many barriers she would have to overcome as she grew up. But with her faith and internalizing the strength and values of her family, with the strongest influence being her grandmother, this would help shape her as the woman she would later become. Now, as most of us are wondering where the name change came in, this can be credited to her brother, Bailey Johnson Jr. Since she was having trouble pronouncing her name Marguerite because of a stutter, he began calling her Mai for my sister, although depending on the source, how Maya came out varies. Angelou is a variation of her husband Anastasios Angelopoulos, sorry for the Greek butchering there, his last name combined with her nickname Maya, thus creating Maya Angelou. This came about with the beginning of her career as a nightclub singer. But backtracking to her childhood, if I may, this is not to say the hardship ceased. She was a victim of sexual assault at the age of 8 by her mother's boyfriend, to which family members killed him upon her revealing what had happened. She later stopped speaking for 5 years because she believed that her words brought death. Although many believed she would not speak again, her grandmother believed that when she was ready, she would. And aren't we grateful she did. She got involved in the arts, singing, dancing, poetry, the usual. But although this was one way she exercised her creativity, she also had to do things to survive. I will not go into the depths of this past, for I do not want to overshadow the tribute with her struggles, but with her accomplishments. But do know this, she is a testament to the saying, what kills you only makes you stronger. She traveled abroad, mastering the languages of French, Spanish, Italian, Arabic, and the Fanti, a West African language. She was involved in the civil rights movement, working closely with Dr. Martin Luther King. She was a published author, teacher, lecturer, and playwright. She has countless awards and doctorates to boot. She is a pillar for young people to aspire to and role model to keep as a mentor, especially for women of color. She is the epitome of not letting ignorance or hardship stop you from reaching your potential in a world where the odds can be stacked against you because of the color of your skin, your racial background, or your history. Although Dr. Angelou left us on May 28th of this year, she is never truly gone. The knowledge and wisdom that she has left behind is one that will continue on for a lifetime. It does not begin and end with her, but it is up to us, the next generation, to pick up the torch and keep this wisdom and knowledge burning in our hearts and in our minds. Now, I know that I have probably not done her memory justice with this piece, but there are many facets of Maya Angelou that I could have delved into, many that I have not covered in depth or at all. In order to do so properly, I would need much more time, and time is what I do not have at the moment. But the time I did get to speak about Dr. Angelou, I am truly honored to have been given this opportunity. I would now like to finish off with one of her well-known poems, Still I Rise. You may write me down in history with your bitter, twisted lies. You may tread me in the very dirt, but still, like dust, I rise. Does my sassiness upset you? Why are you beset with gloom? 'Cause I walk like I've got oil wells pumping in my living room? Just like moons and like suns, with the certainty of tides, just like hope springing high, still I'll rise. Did you want to see me broken? Bowed head and lowered eyes, shoulders falling down like teardrops, weakened by my soulful cries. Does my haughtiness offend you? Don't take it awful hard, 'cause I laugh like I've got gold mines digging in my own backyard. You may shoot me with your words, you may cut me with your eyes, you may kill me with your hatefulness, but still, like air, I'll rise. Does my sexiness upset you? Does it come as a surprise that I dance like I've got diamonds at the meeting of my thighs? Out of the huts of history's shame, I rise. Up from a past that's rooted in pain, I rise. I'm a black ocean, leaping and wide. Welling and swelling, I bear in the tide. Leaving behind nights of terror and fear, I rise. Into a daybreak that's wondrously clear, I rise. Bringing the gifts that my ancestors gave, I am the dream and the hope of the slave. I rise, I rise, I rise.
Oh, thank you.
Thanks, Mercedes.
Wow. We'll be right back on Spitfire.
Spitfire breathes the lives of women of color in Montreal.
We had to speak our truth and to say no to the silencing of our voices in a racist and sexist society.
Spoken word. Interview.
What's that?
Hot.
Spitfire breathes the lives of women of color in Montreal.
Tune in to Spitfire every last Wednesday of the month from 6 to 7 p.m. on 90.3 FM CKUT Radio.
Carnival and TNT is so special to all that we like. We need blood and living, that's how we feel.
Welcome back to Spitfire. That was It's Carnaval by Destra, the Trinidadian Calypsonian. The time is 6:20, and the weather is muggy and, you know, sweaty. I don't know. I'm supposed to adapt to this by now. All right, Simi, I heard you have a funny story for us.
Yeah, I have a little bit of an interesting story. Maybe a guide to how to get your man to put a ring on it.
Always need that.
Clearly. Know me all. So New York native Stephanie Smith, who was a senior reporter for the New York Post, decided to embark on a quest to make her boyfriend 300 sandwiches in a bid to get him to put a ring on it.
Terrible.
And, yep. Apparently, every morning, her partner, Eric Schultz, would ask, "Honey, how long have you been up for?" Then he'd say, "You've been up for 15 minutes and you still haven't made me a sandwich?"
Oh, my God. How dare she?
How, like, God, the horror. Oh, my God. I guess one morning she was pretty sick and tired of hearing him ask her the exact same question every single morning. And she finally capitulated and fixed him a sandwich. And to which he responded, "Babes, this is delicious. This is the best sandwich ever. You're like 300 sandwiches away from an engagement ring."
Wow.
And of course, her response to this was, "Challenge accepted." So now her overarching concern with this whole, I guess, 300 sandwiches challenge wasn't necessarily what any of us would expect. Her concern was this: for three sandwiches a week times 4 weeks a month times 12 months a year meant that I wouldn't be done until I was deep into my 30s. How would I finish 300 sandwiches in time for us to get engaged, married, and have babies before I exited my childbearing years?
Oh, dear.
Oh, no.
I'm stressed.
I mean, my thinking was it might have behooved Stephanie to do a little bit more calculating and to maybe realize that binding herself for all eternity to a dude who kept her in thrall for 300 sandwiches might not be the best life decision. I'm just saying. So Stephanie, a young black woman, got to making sandwiches for her blonde-haired, blue-eyed boyfriend and memorialized the entire incident on her blog and social media for the internet's delectation. So by sandwich number 257, boyfriend dude decided to propose, saving her the toil and mental energy of coming up with 43 other wildly creative sandwich recipes, which I found truly magnanimous of him. I found this story horrifying and problematic on multiple levels, but my initial knee-jerk reaction to the obvious creepy and douchey power dynamics that were at play were probably best encapsulated in this Gawker quote, which goes something like this: "This story is like something out of a fairy tale, one of those weird old German ones you can't read to kids, where a peasant girl's stepmother forces her to make 300 sandwiches for the devil. And then a series of horrible things happen to the girl, and at the end of the story, she freezes to death and dies." Well, she freezes to death. So this entire incident, I felt, was cringeworthy and unsettling for multiple reasons. Firstly, clearly was the obvious misogyny. Secondly, the whole entire imagery of a young black woman toiling away in the kitchen for a blonde-haired, blue-eyed boyfriend. And third, I guess, a major underlying aspect of her whole project was the documentation and commoditization of her experience via social media. I guess we now refer to that as branding. Apparently, she's now signed a book deal, and
she lean into sandwiches.
What?
300 sandwiches, my journey.
Yes, and apparently, possibly, who knows? There might even be a rom-com in the making, guys.
Like, actually, though.
It already is a reality TV show.
It clear, yes, yes, on MTV and VH1,
starring a big sandwich.
Jared from Subway.
And who knows, I mean, if it's going to be a rom-com, who best to play it but, you know, Kerry Washington? Because we know Lupita is a little too edgy, and there is only room for one young black starlet to shine in Hollywood. But I digress. I just want to move on to some of our, I guess, just a little bit of a discussion. What are your, I guess, initial and overall thoughts and reactions to this whole...
One slap. I said it before. One slap. That's all this girl needs. Like, I'm sorry. I get that depending on how long you're in a relationship, like, I can't speak from experience. Like, yes, it's, like, the dream to get engaged, but to do it by making sandwiches, I mean, like, where's the love? Isn't that what a relationship's about? Like, I don't know.
Hold up, hold.
Like, if he's gonna, like, manipulate you through making sandwiches?
I'm calling your bluff, Mercedes. Say you were in a relationship with somebody who's a man.
Yeah.
And if he did this, if he did something, you know, less sensationalistic, but essentially said, yeah, I'll marry you after you do X, Y, and Z, you might want to pop him one, but how do you not think that that's going to subconsciously seep in somehow?
No, for sure. But at the same time, like, I wouldn't act on it because then it's just me bending to his whim. Like, I don't know.
Women do that all the time. This is just an extreme example.
For sure. And, like, maybe it's just my personality, because that's not something I would do, because I know if my boyfriend ever said, make me 300 sandwiches and I'll marry you, I'll be like, goodbye. You know, like, yeah. No, it's not worth it for
what
me.
What have you done for me lately?
It's like, I don't know. And it's just like you said before, it's just like, all I can think about, it's like, I don't know, my mind, like, flashback to, like, slave days. Like,
yeah,
what is that? Like,
yeah, there's definitely some internalization going on there.
No, there is. But I guess, like, to me, this isn't really, like, I was thinking about it when Simi sent us our piece, because we were going to think about it and come up with things to say. And my first, I kept thinking about it, and I was like, you know, I just feel like I know so many women in heterosexual relationships right now who are doing this to, like, less extreme degrees, mm-hmm. you know, who are, like, saying things like, I just lose, like, a little bit more weight, or, like, you know, like, it's because I did this that he's not treating me as well, or, like, all of these little micro examples and that, in my opinion, basically amount to what's going on here. This is an extremely hyper example, right? Because she's a black woman, he's a white man. Their power differentials are so much more highlighted, I guess. But I just feel like this is what happens when most people learn about relationship dynamics from romantic comedies. Most people learn about sex from pornography and talking to, like, their dysfunctional, like, self-hating friends rather than, like, educated professionals or, you know, just, like, educated lay people who have, you know, wisdom. And, yeah, I don't know.
I wonder if this is kind of something that she... I mean... I don't necessarily agree with this, but I wonder if she finds this empowering in the way that she gets both things. She gets to commodify and kind of market this whole kind of awful series of events. And maybe she actually knows how awful they are, and she's just monopolizing on it. She's just making this huge story. She's getting getting the men, she's getting the money, and maybe she sees it as an empowering thing. But then I find it so problematic that she does, if that is the case.
Mm-hmm. But isn't there always much more money in degrading yourself than having, like, self-empowerment?
Isn't it unfortunate, though? Like,
I mean, capitalism's unfortunate, but...
True.
Like, I just feel like there's always going to be more money in, like, you know, putting, like, glistening your skin up and, like, shaking your thighs in front of somebody than, like, trying to present, like, empowered, you know, not showing my thighs, whatever. Right. There's always going to be more money in the former.
Because it supports the hegemony, right? It feeds into the whole entire system. I just wanted to sort of make a little bit of a link to last month. We talked about patriarchal terrorism. And I guess you could argue that Bey and Stephanie Smith occupy opposite ends of the spectrum. So Beyonce is capitalizing on her hypersexuality. And Stephanie, I think, is performing hyperfemininity in a very sort of gender normative way. So is she also engaging in patriarchal terrorism? Mm-hmm. What do we think?
Well, I mean, she's basically taking the call from Bey. Like, you know, she's telling him, if you like it, then you better put a ring on it. I just got to do some work first. Mm-hmm. So I'm hustling to get you to put a ring on it.
Mm-hmm. And what's terroristic about it is that she is, you know, capitalizing on social media, creating this brand, and, like, making and disseminating this image that is not very good for, you know, the psyche of women and young women, right? So I think that's where we're locating the terrorism of Beyoncé's hypersexuality, in that it takes up a lot of space. It's kind of programming, you know, us in like the legitimate forms of sexuality or femininity. So this is just an extension of that. and it's like making it all nice and turning it into this like successful way to self-actualize your dreams. And yeah. I'm sure she's got like a really nice website that has like, you know, really good user experience and like Web 2.0 colors and, you know, creating a lot of talk, you know, social media talk. And so it's really, it's kind of sick in how deceptive that sugarcoating, you know, cupcake, apron, pretty color sort of image of something that is pretty serving patriarchy, essentially, where she gets love and legitimacy through service. You know, and then, like, what is she going to do next? Like, clean the toilet? Like, 300 times two? Like, it's just so awful.
Would you say, though, that she's engaging in it or she's profiting off of being patriarchally terrorized? I wonder if that's even a valuable distinction. Do you know what I'm saying? Like, so rather than she's an image maker in the sense of she's documenting her terrorizing by this white man, right? But she's not pretty. Like, Beyonce's putting those images in our face, like she's booty popping, like in our face, and we have to watch it like over and over because it's always playing everywhere I go. And with this woman, I just feel like it's like canvassing her pain almost, and then trying to like, you know, her in, because in a way she's got to go home and look at herself in the mirror, right? Mm-hmm. But she's just like putting this out there in a way that like it's much more like I don't see her as much as an active participant in patriarchal terrorism. I see her more as like profiting off of its existence in her life.
Look, Victoria's
looking at me like, no.
Can you say she's doing the same thing? Because like, yes, she has to go home and look at herself, but so does Beyonce. But at the same time, she's putting this on the internet for it to be in your face all the time. Every time you scroll down or type in like 300 sandwiches, that comes up. And now it's a book. So it means like whenever you walk in a store, like you're gonna pass this constantly and be like, what is this? And it's always gonna be faced like, after 257 sandwiches your man will propose, which is what essentially the message is that she's sending out there. It's like, do it and you will get what you want.
I also find it, I think, going on to your point, Alyssa, I also find it funny that she's able to sort of capitalize on having this lack of agency, right? So it's interesting because she is a victim of, you know, this patriarchal, but she's also capitalizing off of it. So it's kind of like her lack of agency is seen as something to aspire to, right?
But isn't that the trope of like mainstream feminism today? Isn't that the whole thing?
Exactly.
It's the constantly like trying to navigate between the lack of agency and then trying to say that you do have agency on top of everything, and kind of denying all of these like insidious power controls that have been put in place. Like, you don't question it, you just work with them.
Right. You have incredible agency in the kinds of sandwiches that you can make. You know? Like, you have incredible agency in the kinds of booty popping, you know, methods that you might employ on stage. You know, you have a lot of agency in the kinds of ways that you can commodify and sell your body, sell yourself as a sexual object.
Choices.
Exactly, right? The fact that she's trying to make some cash out of it and turn it, like, you know, not only form her identity, like, I don't know what her real job is.
She's a reporter.
Okay, so this is just like really not in the service of like liberating society, right? She's really like leaning in and taking a cue from all those
cutting board. Yeah, on that cutting board.
It's just ridiculous. It's ridiculous.
Make that white man a sandwich, Miss Smith.
I don't doubt the psychic damage that she's probably like ensuing in this identity formation and her calling, it seems, that this seems to be like a big project for her right now. But I'm not sure if it's like really a plea for help. Yeah. Like, it's evident to us that it's like help is needed, but
there's just so much money in being dumb and basic. It's so
That's another conversation.
Right. We have to wrap it up because we have more show, because we only have 1 hour a month.
I would like to end it with some optimism here. I think there's a lot of value in being yourself and looking within and maybe, you know, going against the grain and seeing what happens when one does that. Like, for example, our lovely Laverne Cox, who is nothing but herself, right? And let's just celebrate that.
Stamps.
See how much money she has compared to Stephanie Smith. Sorry.
Ouch. Let's go to music before
before I say anything else negative.
Okay, I've got something lined up that I think is pretty fun. Speaking of which, awesome. See you guys later.
Back to Spitfire and CKUT 90.3 FM for all of you out there. That was No Scrubs by TLC.
Oh, that was a nice surprise.
Dedicated to you, Stephanie Smith. Holla.
Okay, so switching gears here a bit, the growing movement to change the R word, which I'm not going to say, it's the name of the Washington football team. It scored a surprising victory last week. So for those of you who don't know what the name I'm talking about, it's the NFL football team name that's super racist. Think about it. On Wednesday, June 18th, a federal agency canceled the team's trademark registration after concluding the name and logo are disparaging to Native Americans. The decision that was issued by the United States Patent and Trademark Office, it doesn't force the team to change its name, but could make it more difficult to legally guard the name and logo from use by third parties, aka they won't be able to make as much money off of it. It was a 99-page decision. And it said the team's name and logo are disparaging. It dilutes the R word legal protection against the infringement and hinders the team's ability to block counterfeit merchandise. The team can reportedly keep the trademark while they're appealing, but Native Americans and other critics of the word have hailed the ruling as the latest sign that the team's owner will inevitably be forced to drop it. The legal case was filed in 2006 by a group of young Native Americans. The lead plaintiff is Amanda Blackhorse, a Navajo activist and psychiatric social worker. The Blackhorse plaintiffs made essentially the same argument as a previous group of people who filed the same lawsuit in 1992 that was tied up for litigation for 17 years. They won the decision initially, but then it was overturned on appeal on the basis that they had essentially waited too long to assert their rights. So we're going to turn now to some short excerpts of the lead plaintiff in the successful case, Amanda Blackhorse, speaking to Democracy Now!'s Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez last week, shortly after the decision was released. So she's talking about why it's important to have the name changed, why it's taken this long, why the term is offensive, and it dates back to its origins. She gives us all a little history lesson, so take a listen.
this is such a huge victory, not only for, you know, our group, but for Native Americans all over the nation, and as well as, you know, our supporters. We have a tremendous amount of supporters who are non-Native as well, and this is just a huge victory for us. I think, you know, I know that, you know, the cancellation of the trademark does not mean that the team has to change their name. I think our biggest thing with this is that, you know, their name, the R word, does not deserve federal protection. And we would like to make that known to the team. And also, you know, we don't think that, you know, Dan Snyder and the co-owners should make money off of a racial slur, especially, you know, a racial slur directed at Native American people. And so this is a huge victory for us. I do know that, you know, the team is going to appeal, and we are ready for that. You know, we've been, you know, through this process for 8 years now. We will continue to fight. And, you know, this is not the end for us. Suzanne Harjo, who is sort of the person who has been pushing this for all these years, she filed her case along with other petitioners in 1992. They won their case under the TTAB in 1999. Pro Football came back and appealed that case, and they won based on latches, stating that, you know, like Amy said, the petitioners waited too long to file their case. And so, or they were too old at the time that they filed their case. You know, each of us were between the ages of 18 and 24. So if they appeal, we are not barred by latches. So they cannot say that we waited too long. We had just become adults at that time. So that's kind of the big difference for us in our case. The textbook definition of the word is a racial slur, and it's a disparaging name towards Native American people. And you know, in my community, we don't call each other by the R word. I've never heard another Native American person call another Native American person by the R word. It's just not something that we do. We have other names like Native American, American Indian, or even Indian, but we never call each other by the R word. And so, you know, the name itself actually dates back, you know, at the time, you know, when the Native American population was being exterminated, and bounty hunters were hired to kill Native American people. And so, you know, one could make a great living off of just killing Native American people. And there was a tier effect that was paid out, you know, the highest paid was for a Native American man, and then a woman, and then a child. And so based off of that, there were news clippings and flyers and stuff that were posted up, you know, asking people to go out to kill Indians and bring back the red skin. So in order to show that they made their kill, they had to bring back a scalp or their skin. And so that's where the red skin word has been kind of passed down. So in our community, we do not use that word.
Makes me numb. Africa. You think it's tough now? Come to Africa. You think it's tough now? You think it's tough now? Come to Africa. You think out there we are grinding like pepper. You can catch me on the motorway selling sugar, water, and pepper. I rep Africa, not Miami. Hustle, hustle with MIA. I'm broke, I'm putting definite stay. You can't trust me like leprosy. I hustle here from here to Sri Lanka. My mom told me to be an accountant. But that I wanna work in a corner shop. Contact Sugu, he's got the contacts, man. I'm illegal, I don't pay tax tax. EMA, yes, I'm claiming that, that. Police, I try to avoid them. They catch me hustling.
That was Hustle by MIA featuring African Boy. You are listening to Spitfire Women of Color Radio only on TKUT 90.3 FM.
Remembering Yuri Kochiyama, legendary freedom fighter who died June 1st at the age of 93, peacefully in her sleep. California native she was, and she befriended Malcolm X. Her activism spurred anti-war movements, and she is survived by four children. Yuri Kochiyama's activism led directly to the U.S. Senate's agreement to pay reparations and apologize to Japanese Americans and others who were interned during the Second World War. Kochiyama was living in New York when she forged an unlikely bond with Malcolm X, and she witnessed his 1965 assassination in New York. She was sitting in the front row of the Audubon Ballroom Auditorium in New York when assassins burst in and gunned down Malcolm X. A photograph of her cradling the head of Malcolm famously appeared in Life magazine after he was assassinated. As I mentioned, Kochiyama was born in California. She and her family were interned for 2 years in Arkansas during the Second World War. They are of Japanese American descent. After the war, she moved with her husband to New York. Her husband died in 1993. After her release at the war's end, Kochiyama dedicated her life to social activism that spanned nationalities and causes. She was a vocal opponent of the Vietnam War and the anti-apartheid government in South Africa. She also supported the liberation of Puerto Rico. She is the author of a memoir called Passing It On. Her life reminds many who are not taught about this or have forgotten the great alliances between people of color and women of color working to end white supremacist capital domination in all its forms. We're going to play a clip from Yuri speaking on the Black Run program Freedom is a Constant Struggle on May 16, 2008. She's speaking with host Kilu Nyasha about meeting Malcolm X and knowing Malcolm during his life.
I'm very pleased to welcome as our guest this evening, Yuri Kochiyama. She's a living legend. She knows Malcolm X, knew Malcolm X, and Malcolm X's birthday is coming up. It's going to be celebrated on the 19th, and Yuri Kochiyama happens to have the same birthday. And she met and worked with Malcolm in Harlem. She lived in Harlem for 40 years. And Yuri Kochiyama, welcome to Freedom is a Constant Struggle. So good to have you back.
Well, thank you so much, Kayla. It's kind of you to invite me.
Well, it's a joy to have you and an honor. I feel very privileged to even know you. You're such a living legend. But I do want to ask you right off, I should alert my viewers that two books have been written. You wrote your memoir, Passing It On. Excellent. I've read it. And Heartbeat of Struggle, The Revolutionary Life of Yuri Kochiyama, was written by Diane Fugino. And it's a biography. And when I read Diane's book, I learned that there was a Japanese delegation that came to visit you and wanted to meet Malcolm. Will you elaborate on that?
Oh, yes. This was in 1964, about June. So when you think of the year 1964, you know that's only about half a year before Malcolm was assassinated.
Right.
But anyway, these hibakushas, it was a group of 45, and hibakusha means atom bomb victim. They came not just to America, they went on to Europe and all the way to Moscow to speak out against nuclear proliferation.
Right.
And the group had heard the name Malcolm. I don't know exactly how they even thought about Malcolm, because, you know, the American press did not have a very good I mean, they would not show any kind of a good image of Malcolm. But the Japanese knew that black people admired him and wondered also, however, why America would be afraid of one lone black man. They wanted to know what Malcolm X was like. And so they asked if there was a way of meeting Malcolm and hearing him speak. And that's when he came. We lived in Harlem, and he came to
me. And that was we, meaning you and your husband and six children, right?
Right, yes. And well, people told us, Malcolm's not going to go to your house. He doesn't know you, and it's dangerous for him right now. What made you think that he might come? Well, I said, well, it's true. I'm not sure. I wrote to him. I did not hear from him, but his office called and said they would do whatever they could that he might come. And he did. And our place was jam-packed. Well, we lived in a housing project in Harlem. And I wasn't sure he was going to come, so I didn't want to advertise it too much and have people come, and then they'll wonder what happened and he didn't come. But a lot of people showed. Our house was jam-packed, and Malcolm did come, and we were all so surprised and just so tickled. People were really more amazed that he would take the chance of coming to a strange home of people he didn't even know anything about, when there were so many rumors that something might happen to Malcolm. And when he did come, of course, the people were just so excited. Everybody wanted to shake his hand. They didn't know if he would shake the hands of white people or what. But Malcolm just surprised everyone. He was so warm to everyone, no matter what color. And people were just astounded that Malcolm has that wonderful way. You could help me on some adjectives. You know, Malcolm,
he had charisma.
Charisma, that's
right.
The word.
Yes.
He has so much charisma.
Right.
And yet, he's so down to earth. Yeah.
Exactly.
And he shook hands with everybody, regardless of what color, black or white or Latino, Asian. And people couldn't believe that this is the Malcolm X they've read about in American newspapers.
Who's always portrayed as a hater and hateful and all that.
Yes.
Yeah. Talk about, you had already met Malcolm before he came to the house.
Right.
And you did work with him, I believe.
Well, no, I was just one of thousands of, you know, followers.
Oh, yeah. I see. Mm-hmm. Okay. One of the things that I wanted you to talk about a little bit about was you were mentioning earlier that he wasn't just a black man, he was a black experience.
Right.
Will you talk about that a little
bit? Yes, I would like to quote that. I don't know who wrote it, but I think it's beautiful that it just fits him, that Malcolm was not just a black man, he was the black experience. He was bathed in blackness, and yet he repudiated his slave name and just added an X, the unknown, the possibility of what might be, the reality of what he became. And I think that's so beautiful, and I'm sorry I don't know who the author is.
Right. Well, he did change his name to Alhaj Malik El-Shabazz.
Yes. Right.
And Alhaj, I believe, indicates that you've made the pilgrimage to Mecca.
Right.
And when he did go to Mecca, was it in 64?
Yes.
Talk about how that changed him a little bit.
Yes, that certainly did change him, but I want to also credit Malcolm's sister, Ella Collins, who made an influence in Malcolm's life, because she wanted Malcolm to grow up as a possible leader of his people. And Malcolm, almost like he knew what was in store for him, he just had it inside of him, a very deep love for his people, and he wanted to know as much of history of Africans and Black Americans here, because one day he wanted to be able to share all that he would learn.
That was Yuri Kuchiyama speaking in 2008. She died on June 1st of this year. Rest in peace. So we want to say happy birthday to Grace Lee Boggs. Legendary activist and philosopher Grace Lee Boggs will be 99 in a couple of days on June 27th. There is a documentary on her life, American Revolutionary, The Evolution of Grace Lee Boggs. It will be premiering on PBS's POV series on Monday, June 30th at 10 p.m. So check that out if you have a chance.
Spitfire Woman of Color Radio broadcasts every last Wednesday of the month at 6 p.m. on CKUT Radio 90.3 FM. You can write to us at spitfire@ckut.ca and check out www.spitfire.blogspot.com. Also, follow us on Twitter at Spitfire Radio.
That's it for now. Bye, everyone.
Bye.
See you next month.
Turn me up. I wanna hear the music.
Yeah.
I wanna feel that vibe.
Turn it up.
Are we on the air?
Uh-huh.
You didn't
hear? All over the world, man. Gotta make that money, man. Make your money, y'all. Just do what you got to do.
Nothing gain, nothing tried. Very few even try. Most just wanna get high. From the cradle to the grave. Don't wanna be your slave. And I'm not gonna take it how you wanna. Love me or hate me. Support me or snake me. Either way I show love. Let it make me or break me. I'm the queen of self-esteem. Don't sweat the cream. Just set the scene. Get screamed like how you mean. Straight up. On a string, like them hoes sucking on your thing, overworked and underpaid for days. Behave, I'm not gonna be your slave. People screaming hardcore, living in the ghetto, sleeping on the floor. What you thought I was gonna rise? Do my thing, get my piece of the pie. You're holding your breath for great God out the sky. Best live your life, cause you just waiting to die. People still taking life for a joke. Can't see the fire, but you blow out of smoke. If you didn't get it, you got what you deserve. And just like that, that's my word. Every day I wake up, seeming on the come up. No daydreaming, got to stay one up. How you gonna sit back and wait on the wealth? Gotta go get it, motivate yourself. If not, you only perpetrate yourself. And at the end of the day, you only hate yourself. If you know me, you know my motto. Take in charge. You got what it takes to make it. Make it all.